This semester we've been looking at David. We've been looking at the life of David. And tonight we're going to do the same. And I think David, if you don't know this, if you haven't, don't remember me saying this in the past, but to remind you that David, this is one of the greatest, considered the longest narratives, longest biography that we have in ancient literature of a single human life. David's life has been written in the Scriptures, in the Bible, in the Old Testament primarily. And we're looking at the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, those two books together. When they were actually originally written, they weren't written 1 and 2 Samuel. We put that on later to help us break it up, to help us read it better historically. But they were one book, a collection, a biography of a king for us to see what is a single human life about. What does it mean to be king? What does it mean to have a kingdom under God? You know, and as I'm thinking through this, and as we're thinking about the life of David and how it applies, I've read David, I've preached David, I've seen David's life in books and commentaries, but every time I preach a text, whether it's the one I've done before or one I haven't done, it constantly drives me back to the end of myself. It shows me what I thought I knew before and what I still don't know and what I need. You know, my office, I don't know if you knew this, but I have an office on campus. And my office is actually located between 2525 Borders and Towers. It's this ugly little building that I love. It looks like the Alamo on the outside. You drive by it, and it has these two big glass windows. And my office faces West End. So I have this great office, and I have an assistant right across the hall from me. And we, you know, yell back and forth about things. It's hilarious. And she works. She lives out in the country with her husband and her sons from there. And she can actually, like, open up her front door or her back door and shoot deer and then, like, drag them into her house. It's really kind of cool. But so my windows face West End, right? So oftentimes y'all come and bang on my windows and scare me like crazy. Or I'll see people run by and wave. Or I'll see people come by, and this particular day, I'm looking at my computer, I'm looking, and the windows are here, and I see someone out of the corner of my eye, and oftentimes people will walk up to the front door, which faces West End, and there's a big sign on it saying, please come around. And I always kind of, you know, watch them walk in front of my window, do the same routine. I saw out of the corner of my eye somebody coming up, and this person was coming up the front door. So I turned, and it was a blind man with a cane. And as he came to the door, I could see him kind of feeling his way. I thought he was just going to continue going on down West End. But he came up the path, came to the door, found it. And then as I got up to meet him at the door, I heard him knocking. I opened it up and I met him and said, hey, how you doing? Where are you looking? You know, what are you looking for? And we talked for a minute. I met him and a great guy. In fact, I saw him today. This is what made me think of this story. I was driving today to the office. And I saw him waiting for the bus. And he said, I'm looking for P.F. Chang's. I'm going down there to interview for a job. I said, oh, okay, well, let's go. And so I walked with him. I put his hand on my shoulder. And we began walking down the street to P.F. Chang's. And it was so interesting for me to walk this man and just to talk to him and describe where we're going and saying, hey, there's going to be a step down. Things that I never take into account. I was sitting there taking into account because I was walking as though I was, you know, blind myself. Thinking about what kind of day it was, what it felt like, but yet he couldn't see it. Telling him how to step down, where to turn, when to step up. Here's the doors open. Those kind of things. Walking him in and talking to the people at P.F. Chang's with him. And making sure he was all right and didn't need to go back anywhere. And it was such an interesting relationship to form with this guy because it showed me not so much how he was blind and I led him, but it really forced me. Even when I saw him this morning sitting waiting for the bus, I thought, man, I'm blind. I said, man, I am blind. I think I really can see. I really, in my life, I really think I have so many abilities to see. And yet I am so blind to so many things in my life. Not just about me, but about God. And I think I have all these abilities, all these gifts, all these things that I actually take for granted because I use them to try and make me feel like I can see. In fact, even just in the last 48 hours, I have been defensive and blind. And even the relationship I have with Megan and my wife and the way that I see things about myself, I'm absolutely disgusted. Because I'm so arrogant to think that I can see and I can't. And I have to have someone lead me. And it's not just another person. I have to have God lead me. I am so blind. And so are you. And it makes you and me and so angry at me and ourselves and so angry at other people and so angry at God because we think we should be able to bridge the gap. We think we should be able to do whatever we want, but we are blind. And what was interesting walking with this man is I held his hand on my shoulder and I could feel the cuts and I could see him on his arm, the scrapes and the scratches of him falling down, knowing that he's probably tripped over so many things and hurt himself. And that is just like me. I am so good at trying to hide my scars, my scrapes, my scratches, because I don't want anybody else to think I'm blind. And no one else wants themselves to be known as blind. But I am. You know, we're getting ready to look at this passage about the ark. As we look at this passage about the ark, this famous thing that so many of y'all that Dr. Jones so wonderfully saved from the Nazis in that old movie that poorly reflects really what the ark is about, we're going to see what it means and how blind we are. I want you, just as I have been in this passage, to be shaken. Not by my words, but by what God is saying here about Himself. Shaken up because He is talking about what when David wants to bring the ark into, when he finds it and he wants to bring it into Jerusalem. He wants to bring it in. He is now king and he wants it to be the center of his kingdom. What he's saying is he wants God's presence to be the middle, the center of his entire kingdom. He wants everything to revolve around that. And he's saying that, but do we really know what it means to have God in the center? Do we really know what it means to have His presence there? We're going to look at just two things tonight. Two things about this passage. We're going to look at the problem of the ark and the power of the ark. The problem and power of the ark. So let's read this passage, these passages together. Starting in 1 Samuel 5, it says this, "When the Philistines captured the ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer of to Ashdod. And the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, so that they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying off, cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day." Now skip forward 20 years, and we're about to read 2 Samuel chapter 6. 20 years later, "And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. And they carried the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it. For the oxen stumbled, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had burst forth against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, 'How can the ark of the Lord come to me?' So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David, but David took it beside the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom to the Gittite 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And it was told King David, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him, because the ark of God." So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of a horn. You know, it seems like from the moment we read that passage, there's problems here with this ark, right? Seems like the very beginning there are problems with it, surrounding it. See, the Philistines had captured the ark from the arrogant Israelites at the time in battle. The Israelites brought it out to battle almost like they were going to hold it up and everyone else was going to fall down, like you see with Indiana Jones. And they think that's going to happen, and then it doesn't. The Philistines totally overrun them, take the ark, and they take it back to their camp. And what they do is they put it before Dagon, their god. And essentially what that means is you have a god there, and when you put another thing at the foot of someone else, what are you saying? Well, that god is conquered, right? But what we see is that God is no one to be trifled with. He's not conquered by Dagon. In fact, they find Dagon face down, and then the next day, face down, hands cut off at the threshold. And not only that, but they start having other problems with the ark. The Philistines have so many problems that for 7 months, they begin passing the ark around like swine flu. I mean, they start passing this thing around, and tumors start breaking out in people. And mice start coming out of the walls. And things start happening. They're going, "What's going on? We got to get this thing out of here." So they actually put it on a cart and literally just go and put some cows attached to it and just let it go and just watch it like just go out. And they're just like, "Oh my word, let it go. Just let it go." So the ark goes out. And so even past that, it comes into this camp of even some Israelites, and they find it. And they open it up, they're all excited, and then 70 people die. And then they're like, "Whoa, we got to get this thing out of here." So they take it out again, and it goes to this place and sits in this place called Kiriath Jearim. For 20 years, the ark sits there. Until David comes into his kingship and says, "We need to bring the ark into Jerusalem and put it in the center." But even when David, not just the Philistines have a problem with it, but even the Israelites, when it's coming in, it stumbles, right? Uzzah puts out his hand and he dies. What's all this death? What's all that? The ark is causing so many problems. What's the deal with this? Why is there so much death surrounding this? Well, you need to know that the ark was never meant to be carried on a cart. It was actually meant in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers in the Old Testament, first few books, it was actually meant to be carried on poles by priests. And the ark itself was a small box, probably about 4 feet long, and it was covered in gold. And on its lid, it had this, and it's even described at the beginning, it had these two angels that were facing each other. And it was called the mercy seat in the middle. And inside of the ark were the 10 tablets of the 10 commandments, a pot of manna, and the staff of Aaron, Moses' brother. And this was to represent, and they placed this ark, and where it was supposed to go was in the holiest of holies. In fact, a lot of these even sanctuaries like this one, even as old and odd and 60s looking as it is, set their way up to look like that. Because as you come forward, there are processions. You have the table here, and then behind it, the curtains even. The architecture is showing you there's a place. And where this was supposed to go, and it was in a tent called the Holiest of Holies, the innermost tent where the priest would only go once a year. And it was said, this was the place. And this is what God says. This is where he would meet them. But wait a minute. If this is God's presence, what's the deal with all this killing? Why such a problem with the ark? Most of us are going to read a passage like this and probably think one of several things. Many of you may sit and read this and go, wait. That's the God of the Old Testament, right? And the God in the Old Testament, you know, was waxing people. He was smiting people. He was putting people down. And in the New Testament, he's all God and loving. But actually, that's not what's going on here. And that's not how the Bible really lays itself out. You may also ask, well, wait, okay, if they were supposed to carry it on poles, if they just followed the rules, they would be fine. If they just followed the rules, if they did everything they were supposed to do, nobody gets hurt, everybody is okay, right? And those bad people, the Philistines, are, you know, put to death, and those good people, the Israelites, are okay. That's not at all what this passage is talking about. And it's also one of those things you may be asking, maybe tempted to do this and go, well, this is why I don't want to follow God. Because following His rules, whether I follow Him or not, there's these consequences. People are not, why would I want to follow a God like this? Let me tell you that what this passage is talking about is enormous. It's enormous because it's not so much about rule following. This isn't a passage about rules. This is a passage about the heart. See, what Uzzah was doing wasn't so much some not following of rules. It was a heart issue. It wasn't that he did something badly. Okay? Bad Uzzah. He touched the ark. It was that he approached the ark wrong. It was a lifetime of approaching God wrongly. Listen to this. It's Eugene Peterson says it this way. He says, Uzzah's act wasn't the mistake of a moment. It was a piece of his lifelong obsession with managing the ark. It was a lifetime in the making. The eventual consequence of this kind of death, for God will not be managed. See, this wasn't an act because Uzzah was just trying to help. This was actually more about Uzzah's heart. This was not rule following. This is not something, you do these things, you'll be okay. You don't do them, God's going to get you. That's not what this is at all. What it's saying is that he had an obsession, just like you do and I do, to manage God. Because we're blind. And we don't want any help. We want to manage God. We want to tell Him what we should do. Uzzah thought he could manage God. He thought he could... See, think about it. The ark is God's presence. It's supposed to show His holiness. It's actually showing His distinctiveness. That's why we sang all these songs. It's showing the distance, the gap between God and us. And what Uzzah was thinking was, there's no gap. He was thinking he was okay to manage God how he wanted. You know, have you ever been to London before? And if you go to London, you go in the tube stations, right? And the tube stations are their subway stations. And when you go in their tube stations, when the trains are coming in and going out, there's this woman that comes over the loudspeaker in a British voice, very kindly says, please mind the gap, right? Please mind the gap. Mind the gap. It's like, what in the world is she talking about? And what she said, and they've even, this is such a popular phrase now. I'm watching people walk around campus even wearing the shirt that says this, mind the gap. Because what it means is she's saying, be careful of the gap between the train and where you're stepping off the platform. Mind the gap, right? As if that's supposed to help you. And what this passage is saying is we don't mind the gap. We don't think there's much, maybe we think there's some distance between God and us. Surely. Okay, He's up there, we're down here. But is there really a distance? Do you really know the gap that is there? I want you to know something about my own heart. I work really, really hard at not minding the gap. I work really hard at trying to figure out ways and to see myself not distanced from God in a gap. I work really, really hard at it. And I'm really tricky about it. And I think that way in so many ways. And I know that I think my heart is this way. And I've been a Christian for however long, 20 plus years. And I still am constantly doing that. I think I do that in so many ways. And just a couple that I want to mention that I think, how do you do this? How do you not mind the gap? In not ways that you are probably blind to, just like myself. One is which that we never think about, is that so many of you, maybe like myself, are from a broken home. And being from a broken home, you may think that you're the golden star of the home. That you're the one that may have need to fix it. That you can take on the burden of the brokenness of your home onto yourself and be able to fix it. And think that you can change it and save it yourself. And if you're good enough, if you can get past that enough, if you can move past the brokenness in your house enough and have everything in your life in order, then you're minding the gap. You don't have to mind the gap. There's no gap. You're good enough. You know, maybe it's when you see something in your life, and so many of us do this, maybe you see something in your life where you see maybe a gap there, and you go, oh, immediately, your first instinct is to say, I need to work on that. I need to master that. I need to get that down. I need to do something about it. When in fact, maybe you need to not do anything about it. Because you think you can bridge that gap. You think you can accomplish what you need to do. Maybe it's the first thing out of your brain when you think of being a Christian. You can't think of yourself as a Christian. And hear this if you're here and you're not a Christian, you're wrestling with what Christianity is. If the first thing out of your brain is when you live out Christianity, it's doing something Christian or doing Christian things or even being at RUF, or being out somewhere else, or being a part of so many things, you think you can bridge the gap. If you think you can do that. If you love to sit in your despair, if you see the gap and you see the problems in your life, just like I do, and you sit in your despair, you sit in your disappointment, and you just almost wade in it, you bathe in it, then you probably don't mind the gap because you think you can do something about it. When you say, I need to forgive myself for this, there's nowhere in the Bible that it says you need to forgive yourself. When can you finish forgiving yourself? What about the guilt cycle that we go in over and over, thinking that we can manage the guilt, how we feel after we've done something, or after we see something wrong with us? If you think you can do that, you are not. Maybe you are the kind of person, here's another thing, maybe you're the kind of person that avoids reflection. Maybe you avoid thinking about these things altogether because if you do, it actually means that you have to see that there is a gap between you and God. So you don't do it. And you avoid having those conversations with other people because you don't want that. Maybe it's just the fact that you come into RUF week after week, and this one may sting, week after week, and you think that, oh yeah, I don't need to hear that. I've got that down. I've heard that before. Yeah, Stacy says that all the time. If you think that, if I think that, you think you can bridge the gap. You know the end of Saving Private Ryan? It's such an interesting, it's such a hard movie, such a difficult movie. And the end of it is such a difficult, it's kind of like, whoa. Because at the end of the movie, there's a line of those white crosses of all those people that have died. And the privates there who was, you know, in charge of saving, you know, who was the one who was saved. And at the end of the movie, after he's told, earn it, go earn it, earn it. He begs his wife. You see him old and gray, looking at the crosses of all the men who went to save him, to put their life on the line to bring him back. And he looks at his wife, and what he says is, please tell me I've earned it. Tell me I'm good enough. And you and I are looking to everywhere else to grab someone and say, please tell me I'm good enough. Tell me I can make that gap. Tell me I can do it without knowing I'm blind. Meanwhile, you have all these scratches and all these scrapes on your body and unwilling to see them. That's the problem of the ark. We think we don't need God. That's what this whole passage is about. But see, the amazing thing about this passage is it doesn't leave us there. It's not just the problem of the ark, but there's a power of this ark. What the ark does is not just show you that there's a gap, but it shows you where to go from there. Listen to this question that David asks. He says in verse 9, he says of the second paragraph, "And David was afraid." After he sees this event, he says, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" He's not just asking a geographical question there. He's not saying, "How can I just bring it up?" He's actually asking a question of reality. He's asking a question of his own life. How can this, if this is God, how in the world can he come to me? And the irony, if you read these passages, if you read them in the Old Testament too, the irony is all the while, the Lord, it isn't them going out and bringing God back and rescuing God. God actually quietly makes his way back to his people. Even on the cart with the oxen. And the answer to his question is not is that God came to them, but is at the very beginning when it describes. Why would the author years later describe what's the ark about in verse 2? When he says, "Bring up from there the ark of God." And he puts a comma and then gives us a description. "Which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim." You see, the power of this ark is the beautiful question, what David's asking, that you and I need to ask. How in the world can we have this relationship with God? It's the fact that the ark isn't just about our separation. It's about God bringing us near. It's about who's enthroned on that seat. It's the fact that that seat is pointing to sacrifice. That seat is pointing, it's called the mercy seat. And that's actually where God would meet with his people. It's reiterating that for us because we know that it takes sacrifice. It takes God's sacrifice to bring us to himself. The power of the ark shows us not only his distance, but what it takes for us to make that gap is that we can't do it, that God himself has to do it. That's why Hebrews says this. The author of Hebrews says, "But when Christ appeared as the high priest of good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation," that's of Jesus, "he entered once for all into the holy places," where the ark would be, "not by means of blood and goats," because what they would do is sacrifice blood and goats in order to go into that ark and meet with God, "but by his own blood, securing an eternal redemption." Jesus' own blood. What it takes is sacrifice. What it takes is blood. And you and I over and over, and I wrote this down because I thought, this is so poignant of me. We sing songs that say Jesus paid it all. But we're always, all the time going, "Oh, no, 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 God, trust me, I've got some stuff I can add in there." We don't believe it. We don't believe that Jesus really paid it all because we constantly are saying, "Oh God," and we feel guilty about it. We're like, "Oh God, no, I have some money. I can pay you back some. I can add to it some. Don't worry about it. I know you don't have to cover it all. I can add some to it." What God is saying is that he's covered it all. He's bridged the gap. We don't have to do it. We don't have to live in guilt cycles anymore. We can live in grace. And it leads David to dance. Notice at the very beginning when they come in, they have tambourines and cymbals and castanets. But there's no dance. What makes David dance with all his might? What can make you and I dance with all our might and actually change this differently? Is knowing that there's sacrifice, knowing that we can't bridge that gap. Knowing again, if you're sitting here bored and your eyes are glazing over and you're tired, which I know you are, just like me, that you must fall before the one whose blood has shed because you cannot, your blood doesn't do it. Your work, sweat, and tears and blood cannot make it. It's only Christ. It's only Christ. And it's not about picking up another religious thing. It's not about doing something else. It actually means, what this means practically for your life, it means just sitting there. It means you just sit there and you trust that He bridges that gap. Because what you want to do is your mind races, your heart rate. You think, what can I do? Where can I go? And it's not just thinking. It's not you just hearing me say you're a mess and believe. It's you believing it. We all the time in RUF, you'll hear me say this all the time. Oh, we're broken. I'm messy. I say that all the time. And you know what makes me sick about me? Is I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Because I say that to you and then I walk out those doors and then I start my routine of perfectionism all over again and wait till next Wednesday until God kicks me in the head again with grace. And I know you do it too. Believe it. Just sit there. Trust that He's at work. Trust that it's not about you bridging the gap. You're afraid. You're afraid that you're a fraud. If you're a Christian in here, you may be afraid that you're a fraud in your Christianity after I say this. Let me say something to you. You are. And you can rejoice in that. You know what being a fraud means? It means that we're trying to leave these doors and act like we got it together and we can bridge the gap and we don't have to mind a thing. You can trust that Jesus and His blood, His sacrifice, is enough. It's enough. I want to finish with this quick story, and it's so powerful. I have to finish this way, so stick with me just for 2 minutes. In 1921, there was a man named Dr. Evan O'Neill Kane. And Dr. Evan O'Neill Kane was an amazing surgeon. In his 37-year career, he had done over 4,000 appendectomies. And he was busy working on one at the moment. Previous to this surgery, he was a champion for local anesthesia. He thought general anesthesia wasn't doing it. He thought, we can actually work on this. Let's move the progress of medicine forward. Let's try local anesthesia. But you can better believe that in the 20s, he was having a hard time proving his method. Doctors around him didn't believe it. He was trying to find a test case to do it. So he's working. He finally does it. He finally finds a patient that's willing to do this. He goes in. They apply the local anesthesia. They exercise the tissue, remove the appendix, put in a post-op. 2 days later, the patient walks out. It's amazing. Dr. Kane was renowned for this. You can look it up. It's in the journals. And it was brilliant for two reasons. One was, he showed the local community how incredible it was for local anesthesia to work. Amazing. He revolutionized local anesthesia. But the second thing that was amazing about this deal was the patient. You see, the patient was Dr. Evan O'Neill Kane. You see, what he did was actually check himself into the hospital. And he performed surgery on himself. He stuck himself with the anesthesia, cut himself open, removed his own appendix, checked himself in the post-op, and walked out 2 days later. And it was brilliant. This is why. Think about it. The doctor had to become a patient that the patients would trust the doctor. The doctor had to become a patient that the patients might trust the doctor. You can trust this Savior. He bridges that gap in every way. Stop and see it. Stop working and see it. And fall before Him in thanksgiving and live for Him, because it's out of His grace, not out of your guilt. Father, thank You for Your truth. That, Lord, we don't think that we need You. We don't think that we can. We think we can live without You. Lord, I think honestly, Lord, I truly believe over and over again that my blindness is just something I need to get over. Something I can work at. Something I can fix. Something someone else can just do for me. But God, no one else can do this but you. Only you can give sight to the blind. And it's in only you we can trust. Because you didn't just say from heaven, do this, live this way, be this. You actually came down and shed your own blood for my soul. And it's in the blood of Jesus we pray and cry out, amen.